Where's the Brotherly Love today on the world? I'm Marco Werman. After Hurricane Maria, many Puerto Ricans got government help to relocate to U.S. cities like Philadelphia. Now that assistance is about to end for some people.
The city of brotherly love. Why we gonna displace this family on Valentine's Day? Where is your love? That's not love.
Also, how your dollars could help tourist spots after they're hit by hurricanes.
The one area that you can help the most would be to actually go back to the destination and spend some money.
Plus, remembering Pakistani human rights lawyer Asma Jahangir.
She inspired so many other women to come forward and, you know, follow her path in terms of speaking up and not backing down at all.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being here on this Monday. It might feel like a long time since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. Actually, though, not even 5 months. So we start the show today focusing on a deadline that's looming for many Puerto Ricans who found shelter after the storm here on the mainland. These are people who got vouchers from the federal government to cover the cost of lodging in hotels in cities across the U.S. For some people, that aid runs out this week, and that's led to protests like this one today in Philadelphia.
The city of brotherly love. Everybody knows Philadelphia as a city of brotherly love. Why are we going to displace this family on Valentine's Day? Where is your love? Where are you showing me love? That's not love.
About 4,000 Puerto Rican families have received aid through this federal program. Catalina Jaramillo is covering the story for station WHYY in Philadelphia.
So the TSA program, which is the Temporary Shelter Assistance Program, give people who don't have a place to stay a temporary hotel room for a determined amount of time. So some of them were eligible until January 11th. Then some of them could be eligible for an extension until this Valentine's Day. And then the last group of people are eligible until March 20th.
And how does the federal government decide who gets to stay in their housing and who has to leave?
So the federal program kind of like go and inspect the houses in Puerto Rico and determine if they are habitable, if they have water, if they have light, and if it has a roof. The problem is that a large amount of people that I've talked to are actually renters. So when they came here to the States, they left their apartments. And even like if the FEMA inspector goes to Puerto Rico to the house they were staying, yeah, maybe the house is already in good shape, but they're not going back there because they're not renting that place anymore. So they don't really have where to go back to.
For people whose housing vouchers have not been extended, what are they saying? What are they going to do?
Well, they're very concerned. They're very concerned. I spoke to Carlos Torres. He just turned 56 years old. He's a single father, came here with his 16-year-old son, also named Carlos Torres. They're coming from San Juan. This is what he told me in the hotel.
Tan pronto llegamos aquí, yo me arrodillé a orar. Nada, ¿sabes? ¿Qué teníamos vivienda?
So he's saying that as soon as he got to the hotel room, he got into his knees to pray. And he was just very grateful knowing that he has housing. But he also told me that FEMA has told him originally that he had housing until March 20th. And then last Thursday, which actually was his birthday, they called him and told him that he had to leave on February 14th. So he was going to have to go get out of the hotel, and he doesn't know where.
I mean, Puerto Ricans can't get deported, can they? So, I mean, if worse comes to worse, they will just stay in Philadelphia and do what? I mean, is there a shelter system for people who don't have homes to go to?
We already have a crisis of housing here in Philadelphia. There's a long list for affordable housing. So this is challenging for the community leaders and the city. And I'm sure this is not only happening in Philadelphia. This is happening in many cities around the country.
You know, I got to say, Catalina, there's a photograph that accompanies your online story for WHYY, and we see a Puerto Rican mother at the piano in the hotel lounge. It looks like she's serenading her son. I mean, what happened to that woman?
Yeah, she's Muriel Rivera. Actually, she told me that she was playing the happy birthday song because it was her son's Yeriel's birthday.
Yeah.
He's 6 years old. They hope they can be able to stay because the hotel people told them that they could stay, but they haven't heard from FEMA any official communication saying that they are eligible for an extension to March 20th. So she has half of her stuff still packed. She said she was packing. She was crying and ready to leave. And then she got this call from the hotel saying that she could stay. But she told me, like, she's not unpacking because she's not sure if she can stay or not.
Catalina Jaramillo with WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for telling us these people's stories. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
In December, 3 months after Puerto Rico got hit by Maria, a spokesperson for their island's tourism industry declared the island open for business. Kind of odd, considering a lot of Puerto Rico remains without power. Even parts of the capital, San Juan, which had been online, were plunged into darkness last night after a fire at a power substation. So I imagine many would-be visitors might still be asking themselves, should we go now or give the island more time to recover? Arnie Weissman is editor-in-chief of the trade journal Travel Weekly, and I asked him if someone is considering a vacation to Puerto Rico or Dominica or another island devastated by a storm last year, should they do it?
The answer is a hard maybe. It would depend on the island, the area. For instance, in Puerto Rico, Old San Juan has been up and running. They do have occasional issues. I think what happened with the power outage was certainly unpredictable and not typical. But when you look at, there's a desire to help a destination often, and there's nothing better you could do than stay at their hotels, eat at their restaurants, and shop. If you look at what a lot of the people there have been facing, they may have lost loved ones, they may have lost property, and they may very well have lost their source of income because they're tourism workers. The one area that you can help the most would be to actually go back to the destination and spend some money.
I mean, you've got well-heeled tourists happy to be on vacation and people who are in pain, who are suffering. And we recall the terrible earthquake in Haiti in 2010. There were cruise ships that continued to anchor at a beach there. I mean, it was far from the devastation, but there were people who were outraged by the optics of these tourists in a country with so much suffering. You just said that some would bring money, much-needed money, to the country. So how do you kind of weigh that out?
Yeah, I mean, there's really is a sense, first of all, you know, do you want to vacation? And when I say vacation, I mean lying on the beach, doing all the types of things someone likes to do during their leisure time in an area that's just experienced significant tragedy. And what I think you have to do is be very sensitive to the destination, the people there themselves.
What is your opinion of voluntourism, people who are tourists but also in their time there, wherever they go, they build walls or dig ditches? Is that helpful?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I think you have to vet very carefully the organization you're doing it with. There's actually an organization, a nonprofit, that is in the travel industry in the U.S. that has developed a program for travel agents called Good Travel Advisors, and they are helping travel agents be able to decide which of these programs actually is helpful and which are actually just exploitive.
Arnie, there's also the other concern of disaster tourism investment. There are reports of Wall Street investors who are looking at San Juan, Puerto Rico as a place to buy cheap and sell high right now. And there's also Robert De Niro reportedly sticking to his plans to build a Nobu resort in Barbuda, which was, as you know, 95% destroyed by Hurricane Maria. One headline asks if De Niro is a privatization hero. I guess I'd ask the same about all these investors. They are bringing money. They're helping rebuild, but it feels opportunistic. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that capital has no morals. If they're there and nobody else is, then it can help rebuild, for sure. But it's also, I would say, questionable about if this would be the absolute appropriate thing to do at this moment. That could be very good. But if it's a completely exploitive situation, I'd feel queasy.
Arnie Weissman, the editor-in-chief of Travel Weekly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
If someone in your family is sick with the flu, you already know this. The flu season this year is bad, maybe even record-breaking bad, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Last week, the CDC said this could be the worst flu outbreak since the 2009 swine flu pandemic. Definitely does not sound good. Tomorrow, the World's Livable Planet editor Peter Thompson will be moderating a discussion on this very topic at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, which we'll be streaming live on our Facebook page. One of the panelists will be Dr. Mark Lipsitch. He's a professor of epidemiology and is a director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard. Dr. Lipsitch, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First question, did you get a flu shot this year?
I did.
All right, great. I did too. But as I hear, that doesn't necessarily mean you won't get the flu. So why is the flu so bad this year?
The flu is so bad this year for a few reasons we understand and some we don't. The ones that we understand are that it is a predominantly H3N2 year. That's one of the four strains of flu that circulates every year. And H3N2 is known to be the most severe in terms of the symptoms and the consequences it causes for people. So that's one reason. We don't really understand why H3N2 is predominating this year, but it is. Another reason why the flu is bad this year is that the vaccine is effective to a reasonable degree against influenza B, but it is not very effective against H3N2, and that's been a problem in the past. It's a problem again this year. We don't have the final numbers or even the interim numbers from the United States, but data from Canada and from Australia before that showed that the vaccine was only marginally effective against the H3N2 strain.
Yeah, so what is so different about this strain of H3N2 that makes this flu season especially bad?
I don't really think it's well understood why H3N2 is more severe, but it always has been since it emerged in 1968 as a pandemic strain. It's always been the cause of the more severe seasons, and H1N1, the other influenza A strain, has been bad, but not as bad.
So at this point in the season, this may be a crazy question. Is it too late for the flu shot to be effective?
The flu season is still underway, and it will still be going for several weeks. So there is a benefit to getting the flu shot now. And even 10 or 20% reduction in risk is better than no reduction in risk. It's a safe vaccine, and you know, I had it, and your arm hurts for a day, and then it stops hurting, and it's a small price to pay compared to getting the flu. I think some people who haven't had it recently don't remember what flu is like and think it's kind of like a bad cold. I saw a decision tree on Twitter the other day that said, "Do you have the flu?" And the way you decide was, "Do you feel like you've been hit by a truck?"
Right.
Yes or no. And if yes, if you haven't been hit by a truck, then you have the flu.
We were talking about the flu this morning in our editorial meeting, and somebody noted that it is the 100th anniversary of the Spanish flu, in which anywhere from 20 to 50 million people died, nearly 700,000 alone in the U.S. What kind of scenario would it take for that kind of scale of fatality to occur today?
Well, the 1918 flu was a pandemic, so it was the first appearance in human transmission of a new strain to which most people in the world lacked immunity. And that last happened in 2009 on a much smaller scale. So a normal seasonal flu would be very unlikely to create a situation anything like 1918.
Dr. Mark Lipsitch, professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard. Good to have you with us. Thanks for explaining this.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Lipsitch will be part of a discussion the world is moderating tomorrow on the flu over at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We'll be streaming that live on our Facebook page. Again, that's tomorrow from noon to 1 p.m. Eastern. Just look for The World on Facebook and let us know any questions you'd like to ask about the flu. We'll try to answer as many as possible. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The world lost an incredible champion of human rights this past weekend, Pakistani human rights lawyer Asma Jahangir. She was 66 and had suffered a heart attack. Maureen Kasana is a politics editor at Bustle and joins us from New York City to talk about Asma Jahangir's legacy and her influence. So growing up, what were your impressions of Asma Jahangir?
I think one of the first things I remember about her back then in like seventh grade was my father just introduced me to parliamentary debating, which is a huge, huge activity in Pakistani schools and, you know, universities. Teams come in too from Turkey, from India, from China, from Iran, and it gets really intense. And so many people look for their favorite people. You know, like if you ever got into speeches, you always looked at someone and thought, I want to talk like this person.
Hmm. We were beaten badly, slapped around, picked up, thrown in the police van. And the more repression that was on us, the more our resolve.
I'd look at her and I'd think, I really want to talk with that kind of force.
So, Maureen, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia till I was about 10. And then after that, we moved to Pakistan. Really big things happened. The 9/11, the invasion of Afghanistan, the lawyers movement. And Asma Jahangir had been one of the main figures in speaking against human rights violations at that time. And so she sometimes she seemed to be the only woman at the forefront, but she inspired so many other women to come forward and, you know, follow her path in terms of speaking up and not backing down at all.
You found inspiration in this one woman. What did she represent to you and your politics during this time?
I think for many people on the left, like myself and other people, especially younger women, she just represented this idea, this possibility that no matter how male-dominated your field is, whether it's law, whether it's media, there's no excuse for you to think just because it's dominated by men, just because it's a patriarchal system, I have no, you know, means of getting up and speaking up. And she really, she taught us that you don't really have to, you know, give in to those kind of conditions. I'm talking about someone who, I work in journalism, right? So I have most of the time nothing to do with law. She's talking about holding media accountable. And I started my career in journalism in Pakistan in print at The Nation. And I would read her and I would remember that I never, ever want to be on the receiving end of Asma Jahangir's criticism in terms of being a bad journalist. Mm. And that really kept me in line. And I will never, ever be able to pay her back for that.
Do you have a good example of an episode where she did hold power accountable and how that inspired you?
She never limited her praxis, her philosophy, her, most importantly, her empathy to, you know, provincial borders. She never did that. She extended it to all provinces. Not only that, she wasn't limited to Pakistan only. This is amazing about her. She spoke consistently in favor of, you know, liberating Kashmiris, liberating Palestinians. This woman never really remained parochial or super nationalist about her idea of what liberation should look like. Her idea of a world was humanist. It was very kind. It was very loving. And above all, it was very, very just. I guess to me, I mean, I'm 28, but I sometimes feel really old. I look at her and her energy, even till this point, was just so, you know, so impressive. I'd be thinking, I really need to up my game if I ever want to reach that level.
I mean, some of the reports and obituaries this weekend about Asma Jahangir kind of suggest that even her most vociferous opponents had this respect for her. Why? Can you explain that?
You could tell they respected how she would never back down. She didn't care what you called her. She dressed simply. She spoke loudly. And that really, even in her biggest enemies, taught her this, even taught them this lesson that there is no silencing this woman.
So, Maureen, you're here in the States. When you look at this bloc known as the resistance, as in resisting Donald Trump, a lot of people see it as somewhat diffuse and multi-pronged. What would be the Asma Jahangir critique of the U.S. resistance? What do you think she would have said?
I think she would definitely say that, you know, you need to start looking at, you know, Donald Trump as a symptom of a much bigger problem. He is not the sum total of what you're suffering right now. He is definitely a problem. In that sense, she would have some very, very uncomfortable truths to share with the resistance. And she would, I'm pretty sure, given her own political record, if you had the chance to read and everything, she was not exactly pro-Democrats either. She definitely saw problems with them, too.
What do you hope to implement from what you've learned from Asma Jahangir?
I guess the ultimate goal for anyone who's been inspired by Asma Jahangir is to be honest, to be incredibly, incredibly humane, incredibly honest, and not be afraid.
Maureen Kasana, political editor at Bustle in New York, helping us remember Pakistani human rights activist Asma Jahangir, who died this past weekend in Lahore. In Rio de Janeiro, it's carnival time. That means samba schools, elaborate floats, music, you know, one big nonstop party. But Rio Mayor Marcelo Crivella decided to cut funding to the samba schools this year. He cited financial concerns. Now critics are calling Crivella a killjoy. They say his decision is down to his evangelical Christianity, not money. But despite the funding cut, several of Rio's samba schools still figured out a way to do their thing, as my BBC colleague Katie Watson found out.
There are five floats being prepared for carnival here, and they're about 20 metres long and about 20 metres high. They're really impressive pieces of work, and the one in the middle is the most intriguing to me. It starts with the head of a rat, a big furry rat with his mouth wide open. Now, he represents the dirtiness of Brazil, the corruption and the problems of the country. And on his back are the buildings of Brasilia, and they represent the dirty politics of the country and the capital. And then further down the float is a big building, and that is the Petrobras building, the state oil company. Now, that's a company that's been mired in corruption scandals. It's actually been turned into a favela on the float, so you can see a little beauty salon in one of the windows. There's a little bar. There's also a little garage. So it's a corporate building that's been turned into a favela, which shows the divide in this country. 1.5 million tourists are expected for Carnival this year. It brings in more than $1 billion to the city. It's why journalist and cultural writer Aidano André Mota thinks the mayor's attitude towards Carnival is so misguided.
Without Carnival, there wouldn't be Rio de Janeiro as we know it. Samba schools are cultural institutions of absolute importance. Only the perverse logic of Brazilian society could devalue something as precious as samba schools. There's a slice of society that devalues Carnival because of a central issue in Brazil, racism. Carnival isn't a luxury. It is part of our society, part of what I call Rio's civilization.
It's certainly not a luxury for Flavia Jacobi, who's worked in the samba schools for 12 years. She still has her job, as do seven other members of her family who work alongside her. But it's not easy.
Before, it was very crowded here. There were jobs for anyone who was interested. Today, we have to work for two or three schools because the money just isn't coming.
As one artistic director told me, Rio without Carnival is like Rio without the sun. The sun, though, is still shining, and the show goes on for now.
I'm Marco Werman. This man risks it all to get into war-torn Yemen.
I have to go into the cover of night and be super surgical about what I do and very fast and get out. No one can tell I'm American. I don't tell anyone I go.
He's not a spy, not a journalist. He's a Yemeni-American coffee trader known as the Monk of Mocha. And we've got his story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Another day of Olympic action in Pyeongchang, and lots to talk about sports-wise, from Canada's team gold in figure skating to the latest struggles for the unified Korean women's ice hockey squad. More on that in a second. First, though, let's get to the diplomatic action in Pyeongchang. As you may have noticed, North Korea is in the middle of a charm offensive during these Olympic Games. That includes a performance by North Korea's Samjiyon Orchestra in Seoul last night, which, as Jason Strother tells us, was out of the ordinary. Jason's in the South Korean capital following all the Olympic drama outside the arenas.
It's really rare, Marco, that we hear North Korean music being played here in South Korea. This is a 140-member orchestra, and its leader, Hyun Song-ul, is a former North Korean soldier. She's in North Korea's ruling Workers' Party, and she's a very talented singer. But she was outshone on Sunday night during their final performance here in the South when Sohyun, a member of the insanely popular K-pop group Girls' Generation, joined the orchestra on stage and duetted with some of the other singers, including bringing down the house with an old North Korean tune called Until We Meet Again.
Wow. There's another woman we should talk about too, Jason, creating a lot of buzz this weekend. Kim Yo-jong, the little sister of Kim Jong-un. The Western media seem really interested in her. What have you heard from South Koreans?
Well, you know, South Korean media is more or less just regurgitating what Western media says about Kim Yo-jong. I mean, there is certainly some curiosity about this woman in South Korean social media. It's mixed reviews. Some people say that she's a princess, that, you know, she just seems like someone from the privileged class. There are some people out there that say she's an example of a very strong and powerful woman. Like in the United States, political opinions here are increasingly black and white. You have people who would describe themselves as progressive, left of center. They would say that this was a great opportunity for the two Koreas to come closer together, to end some of the hostility. However, conservative politicians and those, you know, with similar mindsets, any engagement with the North is treacherous. And talking to Kim Yo-jong or anyone from North Korea is more or less condoning their nuclear weapons program.
Vice President Mike Pence has been criticized for ignoring North Korean officials and tough rhetoric. We saw the pictures with him and Kim Yo-jong at the opening ceremonies, somewhat icy, to put it mildly. Is this North Korean charm offensive, as it's been called, changing the North's image any, or are people still wary?
I think it's too soon to tell. Again, I think many South Koreans are just glad that some of the tensions that we felt over the past year have more or less subsided for the past few weeks. But, you know, as soon as the games are over is when the United States and South Korea are scheduled to put on their annual military exercises, which always infuriate Pyongyang. And we could get into this downward spiral again. And I think most South Koreans realize that any reprieve in the hostilities could be short-lived.
I mean, one thing that kind of pushes against that is that South Korean President Moon Jae-in got an invitation to North Korea. Did that come out of the blue? Is this something that he's been pushing for?
Well, there was speculation that Kim Yo-jong was coming here with some sort of message from her big brother, and it turned out to be this invitation. President Moon, you know, since he was on the campaign trail about a year ago, has called for better relations with North Korea, but he hasn't confirmed that he's going to make that trip up to Pyongyang yet. His office says that he told the North Korean delegation that in order for this summit to happen, some conditions will need to be met first. He also pushed the North Korean officials to reopen dialogue with the United States. But I don't think South Koreans are getting their hopes too high just yet, Marco.
All right, Jason, enough politics. Let's talk sports for just a moment. How did the first North and South Korea United team ice hockey match go? Who'd they play?
Well, pretty bad news for the women's joint ice hockey team, Marco. In both of their games, they lost 8-0. They were first shut out by Switzerland on Saturday, and today they lost to Sweden. Even before the North Korean addition, they were ranked 22nd worldwide in terms of women's ice hockey. So there really wasn't any expectation that the team would medal. They have one game left against Japan on Wednesday. This will be their last game coming up.
Jason Strother speaking with us from Seoul, South Korea. Jason, thanks.
Until we meet again, Marco.
Well, maybe a little Olympic cooperation between the two Koreas will go a long way to reduce tensions on the peninsula. But with North Korea, you never know. The regime in Pyongyang has shown many times before that it's willing to be ruthless to try and get what it wants. One of those times was in the run-up to the last Olympics held in Korea, the 1988 Summer Games in Seoul. North Korea was determined to somehow disrupt South Korea's big moment in the spotlight. And in November 1987, Pyongyang did so, ordering two of its secret agents to place a bomb on a South Korean airliner. The mid-air explosion killed all 115 people on board. My BBC colleague Pete Ross has this brief history of what happened, as told by one of those two agents who put the bomb on the plane.
I was told by a senior officer that before the Seoul Olympics, we would take down a South Korean airliner. He said it would create chaos and confusion in South Korea. The mission would strike a severe blow for the revolution.
That's Kim Hyun-hee, who spoke to the BBC in 2013. At the age of 19, she was recruited as an agent for the North Korean regime. She spent years training for her mission, much of that time learning how to speak and act like a Japanese woman. On November 29, 1987, on what she said was Pyongyang's direct orders, she and a male accomplice, both disguised as Japanese tourists, placed a bomb on the South Korean airliner Flight 858.
It took off from Baghdad and landed first at Abu Dhabi, where only two passengers, a 69-year-old man and a 27-year-old woman, got off. Meanwhile, the plane they'd left continued eastwards until it crashed in fine weather and on an otherwise routine flight on the Thai-Burmese border.
We now know that Flight 858 didn't crash, but was blown up. Everyone on board was killed, but the Korean agents who planted the bomb didn't get away. Soon they were tracked down and caught, although the authorities still thought they were Japanese.
A Japanese couple suspected of a terrorist link with the crash of the South Korean airliner on Sunday have swallowed poison. The two were detained in Bahrain and were about to be questioned when they took the poison from a cigarette packet. The man died, his companion is seriously ill. They had been passengers on the airliner, getting off at the last stop before the crash.
As soon as Kim Hyun-hee was well enough, she was flown to Seoul for interrogation and displayed in front of the international media.
In a blaze of publicity this morning, the South Koreans paraded the woman they claimed was a Korean agent. Kim Hyun-hee apparently told intelligence officers she'd blown up the South Korean airliner to disrupt the Olympic Games.
At first, Kim Hyun-hee had tried to keep up the pretense that she was Japanese. But after days of interrogation, finally she broke.
When I confessed, I did so reluctantly. I thought my family in North Korea would be in danger. It was a big decision to confess. But I began to realize it would be the right thing to do for the victims, for them to be able to understand the truth.
In 1989, a South Korean court sentenced North Korean agent Kim Hyun-hee to death, but she was later pardoned. She's since married a South Korean intelligence officer with whom she has two children. Some might say she got off lightly considering what she did, but she says she still carries a heavy burden of guilt and was brainwashed by the North Korean communist regime.
There is no other country like North Korea. People outside can't understand. The whole country is set up to show loyalty to the Kim royal family. It's like a religion. People are so indoctrinated. There are no human rights, no freedoms. When I look back, it makes me feel sad. Why did I have to be born in North Korea? Look at what it did to me.
She now lives in a secret location in South Korea, surrounded by guards and fearing assassination by the North.
Pete Ross reporting there, reporting for Witness, the BBC's History Podcast. Thanks to Brexit, scandals that involve the removal of anything now, like playing with the word exit. In South Africa, Zexit is a thing on TV and in newspapers. Zexit refers to the long, some there would say agonizingly long, slow exit of South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, from power. Jacob Zuma has gotten swept up in several massive corruption scandals, and yet Zexit is proving to be a painful and drawn-out process. Late last year, Zuma's own party, the ANC, said they'd had enough and replaced him as party leader. But Zuma refused to step down as South African president and is still just barely hanging on to power. Ralph Matekha is the author of the book When Zuma Goes. Is President Zuma finished now, Ralph, or can he continue to hang on as president?
Well, you know, he's hanging on as president, but I think that all he wants is to actually negotiate a favorable exit package. I think he does get the sense that it will be untenable for him to continue until 2019 elections. I mean, he's almost halfway out.
Yeah, when you say a favorable exit package, are you talking about money? And I mean, he's been charged with all these corruption scandals. What does South Africa think about him getting more money?
Well, I think that the opposition parties will not like that. There were, you know, indications coming out that he was insisting on his legal bill to be paid by the state or some arrangement that the ANC will have to do, because he knows that he's going to be facing corruption charges. He knows that he might end up having to pay a lot of money there. He wants that assurance that his legal fees will be taken care of. But I think the opposition will not like that. I think that is why the ANC or the ANC negotiators cannot offer him anything with regard to this.
Now, you wrote your book, When Zuma Goes, in 2016. Some might say your title actually needed a question mark, but there's another good word here to describe the wave of corruption going under Zuma, tsunami. And tsunami has been a thing in South Africa since 2009. Why is it taking so long for this man to leave power? Why is Zexit proving to be this long, drawn-out process?
When you're talking about Jacob Zuma, you're not just talking about a person. You're talking about a system. You're talking about a network of patronage. You're talking about someone who actually created conflict in society but has been able to divide the society to a point where he just keeps on surviving. That is why even today, the ANC cannot unite themselves and take a solid position towards him. They are divided. That is why he still remains the president. So it is going to take a great deal of work for that system to be disentangled, to be broken apart.
South Africa's likely new president, Cyril Ramaphosa. He's another anti-apartheid hero, but he's also one of South Africa's richest businessmen. Is that the kind of profile the ANC needs for a leader to turn around its reputation right now?
Common sense says that maybe they could gain by having someone who understands business and can work with other stakeholders out there instead of just an inward-looking approach. But the problem is that there is a very strong anti-establishment sentiment within the ANC. That is why Ramaphosa's project kept on being rejected, because of that suspicion that he has got an unhealthy alliance with the private sector and rich people.
Is there a chunk of South Africans who are just kind of done with the ANC? Like, if you were to take an informal poll of young South Africans, like born free, who came of age after apartheid, what is their impression of the ANC and the people who are part of it today?
I think that the student community, younger people who think that the ANC is just concerned about looting, there is no interest in education, funding education and making sure that education is accessible. Those are the people who are becoming increasingly distanced from the ANC.
What is going to be Jacob Zuma's legacy?
A very contentious legacy, conflict within society, differences, divisions within our society, worse race relations, because whenever Jacob Zuma is in trouble, he always alleges racism against those who are criticizing his lack of sense of governance. This is the first president in the country who has had the two directors of public prosecution that he has appointed being declared null, illegal and void because he has made a wrong decision. You don't come across this.
Finally, Ralph Matecha, why did you write your book, When Zuma Goes? Was it an argument for getting Zuma out, or is it a plan for what happens after?
For me, the argument I wanted to position was to say to South Africans that if you think your problem is Zuma, you've got no sense of what is going on. Your problem is the ANC. Your problem is the political structure. Your problem is the opposition party that cannot truly, fully position itself as an alternative. We need a deeper reflection instead of trying to explain away our concerns by just saying it's one person, it's Zuma. It is the society within which Zuma survives for 7 years as the president and still refuses to go. That's the problem.
Ralph Matecha, the author of When Zuma Goes, speaking with us from Johannesburg. Ralph, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for inviting.
$16 for a cup of coffee? Ridiculous, you say? Well, maybe this story will change your mind. It's about Yemen, and it's not about the war, drones, or a massive humanitarian crisis. Yemen has one of the oldest histories when it comes to coffee, but exporting coffee from Yemen these days has become very difficult because of that war. But one man is trying to make a go of it. He's the son of Yemeni parents, and his story is the subject of a new book by Dave Eggers called The Monk of Mocha. The World's Monica Campbell recently caught up with The Monk of Mocha in Oakland, California.
My name is Mokhtar Alkanchali. We grew up in Brooklyn. I was there for my first 9 years of my life. Then from there, I moved to the Tenderloin. Tenderloin, for those who don't know, it's a pretty rough neighborhood in San Francisco. As Dave Chappelle said, ain't nothing tender about that place. It was rough.
5 years ago, Mokhtar was a student and a doorman in San Francisco at a luxury high-rise. His official title was Lobby Ambassador. Then a friend told him about a bronze statue he should check out just across the street from the lobby where he worked.
So I was like, I had never seen it before, and I had worked there for over a year, literally across the street from where I was sitting as a doorman. And I walked in, I see the statue, this beautiful like Arab man were holding this like cup of coffee into the sky. And it just sparked this interest in me, and I just started researching more, and I found all these like ridiculous connections. Like, you know, Yemen being this amazing place where coffee was first brewed. My family, you know, picking coffee cherries. And then I started trying to find Yemeni coffee in these coffee shops here, and they didn't have any. And so I realized there was a huge disconnect because no one wanted to go to Yemen.
Mokhtar started going, working with farmers there, studying new techniques, raising the quality of their coffee. And on one trip in 2015, he was about to return to the U.S., carrying a suitcase of beans for this big coffee conference in Seattle.
And so a couple of days before I was supposed to leave, the war began.
Houthi rebels on the ground fought Saudi-led missile strikes. The airports were bombed. Mokhtar was trapped.
Finally, there was rumors of small ships coming through the port of Mocha, this ancient port where coffee was first shipped out of.
He got to the port, dodging firefights, and to a tiny boat that crossed the Red Sea to safety. Very risky. But he made it to that conference in Seattle with his suitcase filled with beans. They were a hit.
In these like blind tastings, the coffees were the highest scoring coffees on the table.
They ranked among the world's best. The coffee's flavors, tropical fruits, spices, blew the judges away. It let Mokhtar build his business, Port of Mocha, something he never imagined doing growing up.
For a kid from Tenderloin in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, living in a one-bedroom apartment with seven siblings, to even have the audacity to think outside of the box I'm put in, it's unbelievable, like, to think about that journey.
That box you're put in, what do you mean by that?
I was always afraid of not reaching my full potential. As a kid, you know, I loved reading. I had this like little ghetto library in my mom's pantry. One of my favorite was Harry Potter. And I think a lot of kids like love that book because the idea that maybe I don't belong in this world, being limited based on like what an immigrant, you know, where my family's from.
Now, Mokhtar, 29 years old, hustles between Yemen and his offices in a warehouse in Oakland.
We're right in front of the train station.
He shows me stacks of burlap bags stuffed with coffee.
So coffee lands after a 50 to 65-day journey across the oceans and seas from Yemen, from the port of Aden to the Saudi port of Jeddah to Singapore to L.A. to Oakland.
And of course, he makes me coffee. Hand grinds the beans, pours water slowly over the grounds. I ask him about going to Yemen, traveling through a war zone.
How are you kind of managing that?
When I go to Yemen, I have to go in under the cover of night and be super surgical about what I do and very fast and get out. I don't tell anyone I go. Yeah, it's just very difficult.
What's your backup if something happens?
I have my family, my tribe that does protect me, but even in Yemen, like I move around different nights. I sleep in different homes, different family members. It's easier for me because I can put my Yemeni hat on or turban in my case and just fit in. No one can tell I'm American.
Having roots in Yemen helps a lot, along with a U.S. passport. But here's the thing. The coffee he made me, it sells for $16 a cup at some cafes like Blue Bottle Coffee. That sparked headlines. Ridiculous, some said. Mokhtar pushes back, says, think of it this way. People spend plenty on high-end wine or cheese or chocolate. Why should coffee be any different, especially when it's exported from Yemen?
It is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. 18 million people are food insecure. That's 70% of the population. The amount of effort it takes to produce this coffee in the middle of a war, to get these special bags that can retain moisture shipped in. We have no electricity, so we have to have generators on constantly. It's so expensive.
Add to that, port closures, the uncertainty of it all. It helps explain why Yemen has largely vanished from the world's coffee map. Hopefully, says Mokhtar, with peace one day, Yemen's coffee exports will go up and costs will come down. In the meantime, he's okay with what his coffee costs, mostly because it lets him pay what he thinks farmers in Yemen should earn for being so careful, precise about farming their coffee.
And to decide, like, what does it cost for this farmer to get paid, for him to live a dignified life?
In this case, Mokhtar says he pays his farmers far above the market rate, $6 a kilo, up to $11 a kilo at some farms. That's 12 times what farmers next door in Ethiopia can get. Mokhtar says his farmers deserve it. They're producing what those judges in Seattle ranked as some of the world's best coffee from one of the most troubled countries on earth. For The World, Monica Campbell, Oakland.
All right, Monica's story inspired us to dig out this musical gem from 3 years back to end the show today. It's by the Israeli Yemeni group Yemen Blues. Ravid Kahalani is the band leader for Yemen Blues. And for this track, Satisfaction, he rolled in some flow from French rapper Oxmo Puccino. Yeah, it's a party with a little dig at the bourgeoisie. One of the more recent releases from Yemen Blues, a track called Satisfaction. And that is our show for this Monday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.